Hi, everyone. We are thrilled to have Glass Health as our sponsor. Let's hear from Dr. Derek Paul, the co-founder and CEO of Glass Health, which is a platform that empowers clinicians with the best-in-class AI for clinical decision support.
One of the things we're really excited about that folks haven't interacted with yet is we can actually do some pre-encounter clinical decision support. So you imagine you're pre-charting before you go to clinic. You can actually use a large language model to navigate some information you have before seeing the patient to create a summary of who that patient is, but then also leverage our other functions, differential diagnosis, to say, what are some things I should be thinking about before I go in? And what are some history questions and physical exam maneuvers that would help me differentiate and advance our understanding of what's happening for this patient?
If you're interested in learning more about how to integrate Glass AI into your electronic medical record, reach out to enterprise@glass.health. And of course, as always, there is a free version as well as a Glass Pro version where you get unlimited AI queries. Good news, you get 1 month free access to Glass Pro using the promo code CORIAM. We'll link it in our show notes as well as the enterprise@glass.health. And with that, let's get into the episode. Welcome back to CORIAM. Today is part two of our hospice series. In our most recent episode, we had the opportunity to learn nuts and bolts of hospice care in America, who the stakeholders are, who pays for it. And in today's episode, I am so excited to spend a little bit more time on the gray areas of transitioning to hospice care.
To really kind of help us navigate this discussion today, we're again joined by Dr. Harry Han. Harry's our palliative care attending who works with inpatient teams on transitioning patients onto hospice services. Harry, we're so eager again to get back into this for part two of this episode.
Thanks for the invitation. I'm really excited to contribute to the conversation and help demystify this topic. Even after hospice and palliative medicine fellowship, I'm constantly learning new things about hospice. The Medicare puts out guidelines on the hospice benefit, but how hospice is practically delivered is governed by the local agencies and how they interpret the guidelines.
And that makes it so hard. So it sounds like what may be standard of operations for one hospice agency may not be the case for another.
Yeah, and I really think those interpretations are exactly where all of the confusion lies.
Yeah, so maybe we should ground some of the teaching in some cases. Harry, I'm so excited to pick your brain, but Mahathi, do you want to start us off with a case?
All right, let's do it. So we have a 72-year-old male who's coming in with a history of metastatic squamous cell carcinoma of the larynx, who's undergone all sorts of surgeries, chemotherapy, and radiation. All of this has been complicated by chronic neck wounds with infections for which he's been on suppressive oral antibiotics, and he's now even dependent on tube feeds. He comes to the hospital with respiratory failure, and workup shows that his malignancy has spread, unfortunately, throughout his body. He's now largely bedbound and lift dependent, and his oncologist no longer feels that chemotherapy is going to be beneficial to him. So we've had goals of care conversations, and the patient now wants to transition to hospice.
All right, Harry, a lot is going on with this person. It sounds like, you know, hospice makes sense for everything he's been through and his stage in his life. And I think on the clinician side of things, what are the next kind of immediate steps?
Sure. So the decision to elect hospice is really a starting point in the discharge process. It shouldn't be viewed as, oh, they're hospice, checkbox, wipe hands clean, dispo done. Hospice provides additional services, but you want to ask yourself, knowing the patient's care needs, what's the appropriate setting for this patient to get their hospice care?
Okay. And so for some space repetition from episode one on hospice, we learned the two main ones are one, GIP or general inpatient level of care, where our patients need more IV meds to control their symptoms. And the second being routine level of care, which is, you know, taking place either in the home or at a facility.
Okay. So once you have their kind of sense of their supports, their home situation, what comes next?
So you should ask your care coordination team, your case manager, or whoever is in charge of the hospice workflow to place a referral to the local hospice agency. The agency will do their own evaluation for what level of care they deem the patient and get back to you and your team on whether, one, the patient is eligible for hospice, and two, what they think the patient's level of care is.
Right. So I think the teaching here is we shouldn't promise anything to patients or family about what or where their care will be. And the hospice agency will kind of come and give their own input after evaluation on what services the hospice agency can provide.
Yes, definitely don't make any promises. You do want to provide anticipatory guidance that hospice agencies will do their own assessment and get back to them about what patient, like what they can offer. Now, one caveat is that many of our patients are, their clinical situations are dynamic. So maybe you have to reassess whether the patient's level of care changes over time. So maybe one day they may not qualify for one level of care, and then over time they may actually change and they might actually qualify for another level of care soon after.
I mean, I agree. I think hospice is really so much more fluid than I initially realized. So, you know, all of this really does help clarify that. I mean, so based on what you're sharing here, what would be the care environment that you feel this patient we're talking about would be most appropriate for?
Sure. So for this 72-year-old with metastatic laryngeal squamous cell carcinoma, assuming he has some family or caregiver help at home, we'd aim to discharge this patient home with hospice support on routine level of care.
All right. So let's say he didn't have a family or caregiver at home.
So this is where things get tricky. So one possibility is that the family and the patient hires private aides at home out of pocket to supplement home caregiving. And as we mentioned last episode, this could get costly pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Another possibility is to go to an extended care facility, such as a nursing facility, skilled nursing facility, to provide routine level of care. Now, remember that the hospice Medicare benefit for routine level of care doesn't actually pay for room and board at these extended care facilities. So the patients shoulder the cost and pay out of pocket for a placement at these facilities. Now, a select number of patients have long-term care insurance that covers room and board, but many do not. So the case managers can tell you more about their insurance plans and whether they have long-term care insurance.
Man, long-term care insurance, something I wish was still around these days, but... anyways, what about those patients though? And these, you know, give me a little bit of moral distress. You know, they can't afford room and board at one of these nursing facilities. They only qualify for routine level of care. They don't have the money to hire help. What do we do in these situations?
So we're kind of stuck in this limbo situation, right? It's not safe to theoretically send them home, but they're not dying fast enough for GIP. And so in these cases, your care coordination teams may suggest, or patients actually may opt to discharge to a skilled nursing facility or rehab without hospice support, because room and board at these places are more likely to be covered through the Medicare skilled nursing benefit. So remember that patients cannot use both their hospice benefit from Medicare and their SNF Medicare benefits at the same time. And so since room and board is more likely to be covered by the skilled nursing benefit, many choose that route.
Boy, it really feels so complicated, doesn't it?
Yeah. And then I think like with that overview, I think the thing I'm most curious about are kind of the specifics when it comes to patient care. You know, you have this awesome discussion, you know, with a patient about hospice, and then you're like, wait a minute, this person is on tube feeds, they're on suppressive antibiotics, they're on meds like SSRI and DAPT. And I don't know about you, Mahathi, but I kind of feel stressed when I go back to the EMR and I'm like, should I continue this? Should I discontinue it? And I don't know, Harry, can you help us think through that a little bit more?
Sure. So give big picture overview. Medicare guidelines state that the hospice agency is responsible for covering everything such as medications, equipment, and interventions that is related to palliating and managing symptoms of terminal illness that are related to prognosis.
Yeah. Okay. I do remember we covered this last time, and I thought that was a great teaching that like, if they're routine level care, it's $210 a day that the Medicare benefit, the hospice benefit will cover. And if they're GIP level, it's about $1,100 a day or so. And so is there more specifics about how that money is allotted and like what treatments and interventions fall under the quote unquote symptom management for terminal illness?
Yeah. So unfortunately, Medicare doesn't give specific interventions or medications, just that the interventions must help palliate and manage symptoms. So what actually gets covered depends on whether or not the agency agrees that the intervention or the medication matches a reasonable hospice care plan. So for example, one agency may say that we can cover something and another agency says, no, we're not going to cover that. there are private insurances that have carve-outs for specific interventions that will be covered by the insurances and not the hospice, but that's far and few between.
Hmm. Wow. So, I mean, if we're recognizing that there are all these caveats and nuances, how do you think we should start approaching medications and interventions and how they're covered on hospice?
Sure. So when I think about different medications on hospice, I group them into four buckets. The first one, normally covered on hospice. Two, not covered on hospice. Three, interventions that fall in and it depends. And then four, completely unrelated to the hospice diagnosis. So in the first bucket, that normally covered bucket, that includes hospices usually cover everything related to things like pain management and other physical symptoms such as nausea, vomiting, agitation, anxiety, dyspnea, constipation. So for example, PO Lasix could certainly help with symptoms. So for the fourth completely unrelated bucket, let's say you have a patient with metastatic lung cancer who also has type 1 diabetes and longstanding hypothyroidism. Because type 1 diabetes and hypothyroidism are completely unrelated to the cancer diagnosis, hospice can deem those medications associated with those, things like insulin and levothyroxine, completely unrelated to the terminal illness. And so hospice documents for Medicare that these medicines are unrelated to the hospice diagnosis and the cost of those medicines fall on Medicare or the private insurance and not on the hospice.
And we're talking about a patient with cancer. So naturally, I think families might be curious about, will chemo, immunotherapy be covered?
So things like disease-directed treatments such as oral chemotherapy, immunotherapy are generally not covered. They fall in that second bucket. Other things that fall in the second bucket are donepezil for advanced dementia, the expensive continuous pulmonary hypertension infusions such as ambrisentan or epoprostenol also fall into the generally not covered hospice bucket.
All right. So expensive things are out. I think we understand that part. But what falls into the it depends bucket?
So things that fall in the it depends third bucket are things like artificial nutrition, such as tube feeds, IV fluids, antibiotics, some medications that do not clearly fall under physical symptom management in the buckets that I mentioned earlier. So for these it depends interventions, it's considered on a case-by-case basis by the hospice agency. So a lot of times hospice agencies will say no. Sometimes they agree to a time-limited trial. For example, they'll say continue the tube feeds for 1 week or 1 week of home antibiotics, then stop, or agree to cover antibiotics indefinitely. So for these independence cases, I would talk to the hospice agency directly.
Okay, so then in our patient's case, we mentioned that he's on tube feeds given his laryngeal cancer. So let's say he's now going home on hospice. Can we continue these tube feeds?
So unfortunately, it varies with the agency. I have worked with agencies who said no tube feeds. Some agencies who said we'll cover it for a short period of time, and others say we'll cover it indefinitely. I'm really lucky that I have local agencies that are open to considering tube feeds indefinitely in this patient. And so I'd actually talk to them first. But it's, again, talking to your local agency partners to determine their practice patterns.
Oh, that's so challenging. You know, I haven't been in this situation recently, but it's sometimes really challenging to tell a family that a hospice agency that's accepted the patient won't be covering tube feeds. And sometimes I worry that that's going to make families not want to proceed with hospice.
Yeah, it's such a limitation of our system.
Yeah. Yeah, so true. And, you know, I guess it's all good to kind of have this information up front to the patients and family that they can make, you know, the right choice for themselves. I think this will come up also with like IV fluids and all these other things too. So I guess switching gears, I think, you know, back to like, we have this amazing conversation about hospice. You go back to your EMR, you change a code status or maybe comfort measures only. And then like, Harry, I kind of want to press you on this because it is such a like stressful thing for me. It's like, what do I do with these everyday meds, you know, seizure meds, you know, blood thinners? I can like, you know, be in my head and make an argument either way. And just how do you think through these?
Yeah. So when I look at a medication list, the first thing I ask myself are what medications fall in those generally not covered buckets, things like chemotherapy or donepezil, or it falls in the it depends buckets like antibiotics that hospices may or may not cover. So for medications that fall into those two buckets, I would ensure that either those are stopped or you set the expectation with patients and families that this may or may not continue upon hospice enrollment. After that, I approach stopping medicines similar to the way I do thoughtful deprescribing in an older adult. So things I ask myself are, one, is the medication providing symptomatic benefit to the patient, or will the medication maintain or improve their quality of life? Two, what's the harm on quality of life if we continue the medication? And three, what is my patient's anticipated prognosis and their overall goals? That being said, a common misconception is when a patient goes on to hospice, they'll be told you got to stop everything, all their medications, like even their heart disease or diabetes medicines, and only take their comfort focus.
That's medicine. What I thought for a while. I was like, I have to stop everything.
Right.
Yeah, me too. So,
in reality, a big part of what the hospice team does is work with patients and families on deprescribing over time as their illness evolves and their health declines. In addition, when the patient signs on to hospice services, the agency will review the case and come up with their own medication plan that they present to the family. Often that first plan of care doesn't actually make that many changes to their everyday meds. So you don't actually have to create the perfect medication list at discharge or stop all medications.
That is so great. Like, I really appreciate that blind spot, Harry. I didn't know that they also, I mean, that actually makes a lot of sense now that you say it, but yeah, that they also review it and then they also deprescribe or make their own choices too. I think I just had put so much pressure on myself to be like, okay, these are your meds that you're going to go on hospice with. And so I appreciate that. And that does give me some relief to know that there's going to be like a second pass or second review on these meds after I do it. But yeah, again, to press you, what would you do with this patient's, say, blood thinner or seizure meds?
Sure. So for oral medications like anticoagulation or anti-seizure medicines, they actually may help the patient feel better or maintain their quality of life. So let's start with like DOACs or anticoagulation. So let's say you have a patient where they just had a recent DVT or PE, and clots can cause distressing symptoms. Or perhaps I have a patient who has end-stage heart failure with a prognosis of weeks to months, and they're doing relatively okay, but have AFib, they may have an LV thrombus, and the patient and families are really concerned about stroke risk, because if they get a stroke, that would greatly impair their life. So in these cases, I would argue it makes sense to continue anticoagulation, and the hospice can periodically reevaluate.
Right.
Alternatively, let's say I have a patient who's not swallowing anymore, or they're falling a lot, and I'm actually really worried about bleeding. For them, I might say it's probably safer to stop the medicine.
Okay. I appreciate you kind of going through those like situations and how you think about continuing or not continuing in those.
Totally. The other thing I think about is prognosis, right? So let's say your patient has a prognosis of weeks to months, it actually might make sense to continue their antidepressant or their beta blocker if it's treating uncomfortable palpitations. But if they have a shorter prognosis on the scale of hours to days, I'm not sure if the antidepressant's really giving them benefit. And then finally, you want to think about the patient's goals. So let's say the patient's worried about pill burden, right? They don't want to take a bajillion medicines a day. So you want to cut down the pills to only those that are most essential for in-the-moment symptoms. And then write in the discharge summary for hospice that they should continue tapering specific medications that might cause withdrawal symptoms, things like SSRIs or gabapentinoids. Or you might have a family that wants to do a celebration when the patient gets home to say goodbye. So in that scenario, you might say, okay, let's continue most things and then let the patient know that those things might be stopped after you get to that event after talking with hospice. So ultimately, the way I approach medications is it helping people feel better? Does it align with their goals? And what is their anticipated prognosis? And I also think that developing a working relationship with the hospice agency you consistently refer to can help you understand their practice patterns, and so you can develop your own counseling spiel.
Yeah, I think that point is something I haven't done too. I think I just get like a page being like, they've accepted this patient and, you know, don't, you know, ask further questions about things that I'm not sure about, which it sounds like I could partner with them too. And maybe this might be a good pause, Harry, to kind of summarize. I think you gave us a lot of good new information. So it sounds like there's four buckets of medications, things that are normally covered, not normally covered, it depends, and meds that completely are unrelated to the hospice diagnosis. And how we think about what to continue or stop really depends on whether it's helping the patient feel better, you know, thinking about their prognosis and their overall goals. And I think the thing that you have alleviated from me or given me relief about is that it doesn't have to be right the first time. The hospice team will do their own rundown and work on deprescribing over time too.
Yeah, this really has me thinking that hospice care really just isn't as black and white as I maybe thought it was.
Yeah, I think hospice, now that we're talking about it, is much more complicated, and there's a sense of reasoning with deprescribing and kind of what makes sense for this person versus not. Okay, so let's switch gears and go to another case and see what other learning points we can kind of extrapolate from it. Mathi, I think you had one more prepped, right?
Yeah, so let's start with a 77-year-old female. She's got a history of cirrhosis, congestive heart failure, and end-stage kidney disease on dialysis. This patient's been coming in over the past year recurrently for encephalopathy, GI bleeds requiring transfusions, and symptomatic ascites, for which she now gets monthly paracenteses. She was actually ultimately evaluated for TIPS and not considered a candidate due to her heart failure. And just given her overall decline, you know, we've had some conversations with this patient and she just wants to transition to hospice. But she has a lot of questions about whether she can get blood transfusions and continue to get her paracenteses if she needs them. So, Harry, I'm going to pause there because I really want to kind of ask you how we can navigate discussions with patients regarding procedures like this, whether they are for symptom relief or even patient preference when a patient's on hospice.
I am so excited to have Echo Core 500 Digital Stethoscope as a sponsor. I actually learned about them accidentally a year or so ago when I'd forgotten my stethoscope and my resident let me borrow his, and I just was like, wow, I've never heard heart sounds or lung sounds this clearly. You just get this extra level of confidence for those moments where you're asking, was that faint crackles? Was that an S3 gallop? And so that's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies sounds 40x, and then on top of that, it has noise cancellation so you can really hear with precision in a noisy ED or with a really loud roommate or other environments. Echo AI is also built in and helps you detect murmurs and AFib earlier. A cool thing also is that you can record that heart sound that you heard, share it later with your team, or on a case presentation. And then you can really trust the diagnostic accuracy. It's backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for the devices and the AI algorithms. So those who use Echo are twice as likely to catch heart disease. What I think is neat is that Echo 500 isn't just the digital stethoscope. You can actually also get an EKG tracing right on the app when you place an Echo 500 on a patient's chest. So no more waiting around trying to trace down the EKG machine on the floor. I trust Echo so much that I work with a team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/corium. Your purchase will be HSA and FSA eligible and may also qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you're going to detect heart and lung sounds more confidently. And if you don't, you can return it with a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/corium for $50 off plus a free chest cover. That's ekohealth.com/corium. And with that, let's get back into the episode. Here at Corium, we're talking about the real things that can help anyone who works in healthcare. And today we're talking about how the scrubs you wear, they can make a difference. I remember the first time I saw one of my colleagues walking into a sign-out room looking way more put together after a night shift, and I knew right then and there they were wearing FIGS. FIG scrubs is made specifically for us doctors, residents, students, healthcare professionals who are putting in long hours and really need gear that can keep up and perform on our level. We have so much going on in any shift, right? Scrubs are the last thing we want to be thinking about. And that's why FIGS is great in that they're lightweight, stretchy, breathable. They have all the small touches that have made me a true convert. They're clean, they're modern, super functional, tons of pockets that I love for all the snacks, zippers that don't snag, and antimicrobial fabric to stay healthy while working. You deserve better scrubs. You deserve FIGS. So head over to figs.com and enter FIGSRX at the checkout for 15% off your first purchase. That's figs.com, promo code FIGSRX for 15% off your first purchase. And with that, let's head back to the episode.
Sure. So many of these procedures fall under the it depends categories. So specifically, transfusions are considered on a case-by-case basis, more for are the transfusions actually providing symptom relief. But generally, routine transfusions for things like hemoglobin less than 7 are not done. This, unfortunately, has historically limited hospice enrollment for patients who require sort of frequent transfusions. Now, there are initiatives and pilots in the pipeline now where specific hospice agencies are looking at the cost benefit of covering transfusions in a variety of outcomes. For things like paracenteses, thoracenteses, or even things like palliative XRT and bone for bone mets, again, depends on the agency. Many will arrange for paracenteses or thoracenteses because these procedures really do help patients live better by treating things like pain and discomfort. Hospices may actually recommend as well placing like an indwelling pleural or abdominal catheter for ease of drainage in the home setting and contract with different hospitals or providers to setting up the placements of these catheters. For many of the interventions, generally, hospices will ask patients to do this as an outpatient. So in order to get paracenteses and thoracenteses, the patients will need to be functional enough to go do these as outpatient procedures. Finally, things like routine labs are generally not covered on hospice because at this point, the focus is really on the patient's body and their symptoms and how they're physically doing rather than a number.
That makes a lot of sense in terms of the labs. What about patients on dialysis? You know, I think we have a lot of patients who have end-stage renal disease on dialysis. And what does hospice mean for them?
Sure. Dialysis is generally not covered as dialysis impacts prognosis, and so you should discuss discontinuation of hemodialysis with the patient. There are specific patient populations who are able to get hospice and hemodialysis, such as certain veterans receiving care at a VA or children under 21 with specific insurance benefits through concurrent care hospice models that is offered to these patient populations.
Well, you said concurrent care. What is that? Is that like they get hospice care and something else too?
Sure. So concurrent care is a model where patients with a prognosis of less than 6 months can enroll on hospice, and they can also continue to receive life-sustaining treatments such as transfusions, hemodialysis, or cancer-directed treatments. This care model sort of tries to change from the current hospice cliff model, where it feels like patients have to choose between disease-focused treatments and comfort-focused care in a binary, sudden fashion, to having a more softer landing, allowing the hospice team to get to know and care for the patients and families without this abrupt loss of disease-directed treatments, and allow them to gradually taper down disease-targeted interventions over time as disease and function changes. So there's a lot of ongoing studies right now looking at the feasibility, the cost, and the practicality of concurrent care models in the VA. And there is actually pilot studies going on looking at concurrent care with regular insurances in integrated health systems or specific Medicare plans.
Oh, that's actually really fascinating, because often I find when I'm caring for patients, this exact thing that you described, Harry, the hospice cliff, is what really causes hesitation with patients enrolling in hospice. I really love that it, you know, allows patients and families to transition more slowly from a disease-targeted environment to a more comfort-based environment. And I think it just allows people to, you know, adjust and digest this information in a slower and more compassionate way.
Yeah. And I think another like rather abrupt decisions that patients sometimes have to navigate prior to discharge to hospice is code status. And I think most often like people will elect for DNR, DNI, but I do, or even, you know, when we're filling out the MOLS, you know, say don't transfer to the hospital. But I have had some cases where someone, you know, says, no, they do want to be full code, or they have wishes to be transferred back to the hospital if they have any kind of acute care needs that come up. And so, Harry, I'm curious kind of the nuances of that in terms of code status and hospice care.
So technically, there is nothing in the Medicare guidelines that state that a patient has to be DNR in order to enroll on hospice. And hospice agencies work with patients and families over time to readdress code status and other elements of goals of care at end of life. Now, some agencies may push back and say, does this patient who is full code, do they truly align with a comfort-focused hospice care plan? And so you might want to take a pause and check in with the patients and families. What's their understanding and expectation of hospice care? Do they generally agree with the hospice care philosophy? And if there is some disconnect, maybe the patient and family are just not ready to enroll on hospice, right? And that's totally fine. Families take time to think about hospice. And if there's any questions or uncertainties, you can speak with the hospice agency directly or reach out to a palliative care team if you have access to one at the institution to meet with the patient and family. One big thing I'll emphasize is that hospice is voluntary, right? If patients and families are not ready, we can't force them to enroll on hospice. Patients may also elect to come off the hospice benefit to receive medical treatments if they desire, and patients can elect to go back to the hospital or the ED, even on hospice if they choose. In these scenarios, the hospice team would likely continue to talk to the patient and family about whether hospice actually continues to make sense for them. Now, practically speaking, code status does preclude admission to like a hospice GIP facility because they're not capable of running a code or have the equipment for running a code in those facilities. In addition, if there's concerns in the home setting and the patient is full code or still wanting to go back to the hospital, the hospice team may actually recommend going back to the ED for evaluation.
Yeah, definitely. That makes a lot of sense from the kind of if they're GIP eligible. This is helpful. And maybe we can take a second to like think about the person that enrolls onto hospice, but then comes back to the hospital. I don't know about you, but I find sometimes I'm like, wait a minute, how come you're on hospice and you're back in the ED? I'm like, you know, kind of questioning like, wait, did someone really explain to you what hospice was? And did you understand what it meant? And I don't know, like I'm curious what blind spots I might have in this situation because I'm like, wait, why are you coming back?
Totally. It's super confusing. So there's a lot of reasons why patients who are enrolled on hospice come back to the hospital. One possibility that sort of raises to the top of my mind is the patient and family changed their views on the philosophy of medical care. Maybe they decided that they do actually want to pursue disease-targeted treatments or want to pursue specific interventions that's not covered by the hospice, or they actually have a misunderstanding of what hospice actually does or realize hospice isn't what they're hoping for. This is actually a pretty common thought, and the thing that comes to mind, to the top of our mind as clinicians, because why would they come back to the hospital, as Shreya said? Shouldn't the hospice be able to manage these things?
Yeah, maybe I'm being too judgmental. I have had some patients that came back and they were just like humbled by the, you know, they wanted more nursing or more care than hospice could offer. And I think that made sense to kind of reevaluate things.
Totally. Yeah. You know, Shreya, I think you bring up a great point. Patients and families just changing on their minds on the philosophy of care is not the only reason why they present to the hospital, right? So hospices do have their own limitations. Sometimes patients and families may think that home is actually not the best place that they need to be, or they need to get faster connection to resources than hospice is able to arrange in a timely fashion. So for example, I was on call and I was caring for a patient who was home on hospice who became acutely dyspneic in the middle of the night. The family called the agency 24/7 telephone line. The agency gave recommendations to administer opioids and other treatments for their dyspnea, and the agency was planning to send someone out to see the patient. But just after sort of a few doses of the opioids, the patient still looked really distressed. The family panicked. They decided to call an ambulance to see if the ED could help get this patient more comfortable. And while hospices do counsel patients and families to call them before calling 911, in this case, the family forgot to call the agency in the height of the moment. And so when the patient showed up to the ED, there was so much confusion about why this patient was here and what was going on.
Yeah. And then are there situations, Harry, where like the hospice agency might even recommend the patient to go to the hospital?
Totally. So for example, patients on hospice fall, or sometimes they get on car accidents. And so hospices may suggest that they go to the hospital for limited evaluation for symptom reasons, right? After they fall, did they have a fracture that limits their mobility or quality of life? Usually in these scenarios, the hospice will contact the ED or the hospital directly to coordinate care. Another possibility that the hospice may send someone to the hospital is the hospice doesn't actually have a GIP facility or contracted beds, and thus they need to send someone into the hospital for symptom management.
Oh, man. Contracted beds. I can't even imagine. So I think for me, my teaching point is like, don't be like, wait, why are they back? And I think maybe just be a little bit more curious. And I'm curious when you see a patient in the ED or in the hospital that's enrolled in hospice or was enrolled in hospice, how do you kind of think through that with patients?
Shreya, 100% on being curious, right? It's important to ask the patient.
Not be like, why?
Right. It's important to ask the patient and family what prompted them to come to the hospital. Did they actually call the hospice before they came? You know, briefly explore how things been for them on hospice, and don't just assume that they just want to change their philosophy of care. The second thing I would say is reach out to the hospice agency, right? Ask for that 24/7 telephone line from the patient and family so you can speak to the hospice team directly. Maybe the patient and family have been wrestling about hospice enrollment and a change in care plan makes sense. Or maybe the hospice team actually sent them in for more rapid symptom control, but didn't know which ED they went to. The reason why it's super important to contact the hospice agency ASAP when they show up to the hospital or ED is that if the hospice team doesn't know about the ED visit or hospital admission while the patient is still enrolled on their services, there is a chance the patient could be directly billed for the medical care they received if the hospice didn't agree to that particular workup or treatment.
Oh my goodness. I mean, that's certainly important to know. I would hate for a patient to be billed for something without realizing it or if it didn't align with their care. So then let's say they come to the hospital and get some sort of treatment, whether it be for a symptom or something else. And they were unenrolled, I understand, right, when they come to the hospital. So can they then re-enroll in hospice? And if they can sort of just go back and forth in their enrollment, what would really stop someone from both enrolling, suspended, and re-enrolling in hospice every time they feel they have an acute care need?
Sure. So just to name that the patient is the one who voluntarily disenrolls. So just want to say the patient is the one that drives that. Usually if they come to the hospital, then they sort of disenroll because they're coming to the hospital because that's what they elect for. So in particular, it's important to note that patients have to voluntarily enroll and disenroll on hospice. And usually when they get hospitalized, they often will voluntarily disenroll. So yes, patients can re-enroll in hospice if they disenroll from services after getting rehospitalized. Those are increased scrutiny from CMS. Readmission to the hospital, though, should be a point of pause for us as clinicians, where we need to explore, does continuing hospice make the most sense, right? Does the philosophy of hospice fit with the type of care the patient and family are hoping to pursue? If no, it's not the right fit, then hospice isn't the best option for patients and families right now, and they can always reconsider it later. If yes, it still fits, then you want to ask the hospice agency to reevaluate, right? Because it's a new admission, they have to reevaluate candidacy for hospice at that time.
Yeah, that's really tricky, but I'm glad to know that they do have that option to re-enroll. Maybe I can just go through some other potpourri of questions that I just have lingering in my mind. I just had a patient recently where, they kind of commented, my friend's mom went on hospice and they died 2 days later. They started a morphine drip and then they quickly became unresponsive. And so I'm curious if you've gotten questions or comments like that and how do you respond?
So yes, sadly, I often hear these comments. In that first scenario, my friend's mother went on hospice and died 2 days later. I actually often tell patients and families that unfortunately, we as clinicians wait too long to start hospice services and the patient gets enrolled on services when they're actively dying. And so their time on hospice is really short. My hope and our hope is to start hospice services earlier so patients can get more time with their loved ones and get additional supports in the home setting rather than waiting until we're at death's door. For that second comment of, the hospice started morphine and then the patient became quickly unresponsive or something like that, I often tell patients and families, my hope is that the patient will be awake, interactive, and comfortable and not suffering. I also share that sometimes it's really easy for that to be accomplished, and other times it's harder to balance wakefulness and interactiveness with trying to keep someone comfortable from their symptoms as their clinical condition evolves. I share that the hospice agency will work with patients and families on these goals together to make decisions about how best to manage symptoms and how do we balance between wakefulness and comfort.
Yeah, so there's also some expectation setting too. Okay, so Harry, thank you so much for spending time with us and helping us understand all these nuances and gray areas in these end-of-life scenarios. And I think we all have a lot we can do to continue to improve the way we care for patients during these, vulnerable times. And on that note, do you have your own reflections about kind of the future of hospice care? I know you mentioned the concurrent hospice care model that people are trying out. What's down the pipeline? Are things going to get better?
So the Medicare hospice benefit was enacted in 1982. So the regulations are over 40 years old now. And since then, so many things in medicines have changed, right? People are living longer. We have newer treatments. Some life-sustaining treatments are even done outside the hospital setting now. Everyone, a bunch of people go home on infusions. They get all these things. So as we heard in the last episode, 40 years ago, most patients who enrolled on hospice had end-stage cancer. And now we have more heterogeneity in the types of serious illnesses that are enrolled on hospice or different illness trajectories. And patients living with different serious illnesses may have different physical and functional needs at end of life. And so how does our current hospice system support those needs? The second thing to think about is family structures, right? Family structures have evolved with the advent of cell phones and internet and FaceTime and the ability that people live far, far away. You know, it's not uncommon now that we have 80-year-olds being the sole caregiver for an 82-year-old spouse who's on home hospice. And their support network is scattered across the country, and funding structures for caregiving haven't been kept up. You know, finally, as we think about the rise of healthcare corporatization, hospital system mergers, the rise of for-profit agencies or private equity, that's just not entering sort of the hospital and clinic system. That's also entering the nursing home markets as well as the hospice markets and can impact care delivery. So what was implemented 40 years ago may or may not suit the needs of the 21st century healthcare system. You know, there is good news. I don't want to sort of be doom and gloom about sort of hospice, but there's the good news is that there's a growing recognition that about the benefits and challenges of the current Medicare hospice benefit. And there's, as we talked about before, there's pilots to think about alternative hospice care models like, you know, concurrent care. So for example, the recent Medicare Choices model is a care model similar to concurrent care, was recently piloted with 82 hospices and other insurance companies. So this gives me hope that hospice care will evolve to better meet the needs of our patients and caregivers.
Yeah, there's so much realness there. And I really do hope it gets better. And I think there's so much, you know, hard things to process at the end of life. And I think if the hospice benefit was more inclusive to our patients' needs, there would be a lot of good there. Harry, again, thank you so much. You gave us a ton to reflect on.
Absolutely. Harry, thank you so much. Honestly, since we've started working on this episode, I've learned so much that it's changed how I've practiced with my patients who are navigating these conversations and these transitions. So I really hope that, and I think we all hope that you guys as listeners are able to use some of this as well. I think we'll leave you now with a clip from a beautiful discussion we had with Brianna Tobin from episode 1. I think about this quote often since our interview, and it really makes me reflect on the why for hospice care and how it should just remain an ongoing topic of discussion.
A centering on the quality of life that's remaining for the individual, because sometimes we think about hospice and we think, oh, well, this person's going to die in 6 months. You know, you ask anybody what hospice is, and that's probably what they're going to say if they understand even kind of a little bit about hospice. But what the nuance is that we don't really talk about or reflect upon enough is that you can't have the end of life and the challenges of the end of life without the joys of being alive. Like, they come together. We are born, we die. We exist in a dichotomy throughout our entire lives. So hospice is not just about dying, but it's about living.